Good morning. You know, there are some mornings I walk up here and feel like I'm just interrupting the worship. This is kind of one of those Sundays. I listen to these songs all the time, but there's something about hearing our people playing and singing them and hearing you as the congregation singing it that just makes it special. And in kind of a strange way, something I wish we didn't have to stop. But I know that God's Word is important. We're to be people of the Word. And that's why we strive to not only sing the Word and pray the Word, but preach the Word as well. And even in our ordinances, we see the Word visibly. So this morning, we're in Nehemiah. We're going to be in Nehemiah chapter 3 today, which I'm sure as we get into this, you'll see that it's a very commonly read chapter. I'm sure it's one of your favorites. Maybe you'll see why there's a little sarcasm in that statement as we go on. Last week, we worked our way through chapter 2, and we pointed out some highlights of the way Nehemiah prepared for this task. We saw how he combined his praying and his thinking, which was a lesson to us not to try to separate the two. We saw his planning, we saw his research, and then we saw how he motivated the workforce. Today, as we move on to chapter 3, we're going to take a closer look at Nehemiah's organization. As you look at chapter 3, you'll see a roster of builders, and it really shows that the work was delegated amongst some 40 or 41 different groups. Depending on how you read this list, there's some disagreement there. But what we'll see is that by dividing the work this way, Nehemiah, what he accomplished was to have the entire wall built together rather than just moving all the way around it one section at a time. And we'll see that all kinds of people pitched in, priests, including the high priest, pitched in, Levites, temple servants, goldsmiths, merchants, city officials, private individuals, even women, which was unusual for that day, contributed. Men from different places like Tekoa and Gibeon and Mizpah and other towns around Jerusalem, all took part. This chapter is really just a detailed account of how the gates and the walls of Jerusalem were rebuilt, and it focuses on the names of the people that did it. So I ask you, can anything be more uninteresting than a list of names, particularly names that we can just barely pronounce? Many people think so, that it's entirely uninteresting. And it's not just lay people. I have a great book. It was written, 25 years ago probably, by Charles Swindoll. And it's called Hand Me Another Brick. And it is essentially a study of the book of Nehemiah. And it's a very good book. I recommend it. It's an excellent study of the book. But in his book, what's interesting is that he completely skips chapter 3. He moves from chapter 2, which of course, as we've already dealt with, talks about how Nehemiah challenges the people to work. And he goes from there to chapter 4, which deals with the opposition that the builders will face. Hopefully this morning, as we go through this, you'll see that it's actually a very important section of the book, and that it can even be interesting to us. And maybe, with all due respect, Mr. Swindoll might have made a mistake by skipping it entirely. So let's jump in. Chapter 3 of Nehemiah. The words should be on the screen behind me. There are Bibles under some of the chairs in front of you. You might have to scoot down a little bit to find one. But let's go through the entire chapter together, verses 1 through 32. Nehemiah chapter 3. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred, as far as the Tower of Hananel. And next to them, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zachar, the son of Imri, built. The sons of Hasaniah built the fish gate. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakoz, repaired. And next to them, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, repaired. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Baana, repaired. And next to them, the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve their lord. Joiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besadeah, repaired the gates of Yeshana. They laid its beams and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And next to them repaired Melatiah the Gibeonite, and Jadon the Meronothite, the men of Gibeon and of Mizpah, the seat of the governor of the province beyond the river. Next to them Uziel, the son of Harhaiah, goldsmiths, repaired. Next to him, Hananiah, one of the perfumers, repaired, and they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. Next to them, Raphaiah, the son of Hur, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired. Next to them, Jedaiah, the son of Haramuth, repaired opposite his house. And next to him, Hadash, the son of Hashabniah, repaired. Melchijah, the son of Haram, and Hashab, the son of Pathmoab, repaired another section of the Tower of the Ovens. Next to him, Shalom, the son of Halohesh, ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, repaired, he and his daughters. Hanan, the inhabitants of Zanoa, repaired the valley gate. They rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars, and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate. Malchijah, the son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth Hekarim, repaired the dung gate. He rebuilt it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And Shalom, the son of Kalhoza, ruler of the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate. He rebuilt it and covered it and set its doors, its bolts, and its bars. And he built the wall of the pool of Shelah of the king's garden as far as the stairs that go down from the city of David. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, ruler of half the district of Beth-Zur, repaired to a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool and as far as the house of the mighty men. After him, the Levites repaired. Rehum, the son of Bani, next to him, Hashabiah, ruler of half the district of Keilah, repaired for his district. After him, their brothers repaired. Bavi, the son of Henadad, ruler of half the district of Keilah. Next to him, Ezer, the son of Jeshua, ruler of Mizpah, repaired another section opposite the ascent to the armory at the buttress. After him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, repaired another section from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. After him, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, son of Hakoz, repaired another section from the door of the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib. After him, the priests, the men of the surrounding area, repaired. After them, Benjamin and Hashab repaired opposite their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Maaseiah, son of Ananiah, repaired beside his own house. After him, Benui, the son of Henadad, repaired another section from the house of Azariah to the buttress and to the corner. Palal, the son of Uzai, repaired opposite the buttress and the tower projecting from the upper house of the king at the court of the guard. After him, Padiah, the son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on Ophel repaired to a point opposite the water gate on the east and the projecting tower. After him, the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting tower as far as the wall of Ophel. Above the horse gate, the priests repaired, each one opposite his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, repaired opposite his own house. After him, Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, repaired. After him, Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zaleph, repaired another section. After him, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, repaired opposite his chamber. After him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants opposite the muster gate and to the upper chamber of the corner. And between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. That's a lot of names. And it seems at first glance to be rather boring, doesn't it? And we tend to treat lists like this in the Bible in that way, whether they be genealogies or, in this case, lists of workers. But I think there's truths here that we can see. In fact, I hope you'll see that when this chapter is properly understood, this is quite the achievement. Here's how the chapter is described by one commentator. His name is Howard F. Voss. He says, what appears at first blush to be a list of forgotten names and boring details of wall construction, on closer examination becomes something quite dramatic and exciting. It may be observed first that what occurred was the result of an incredible feat of organization. The entire community was mobilized and was led to work harmoniously and simultaneously on all parts of the city wall, which was divided into 40 or 41 sections. Second, the entire work demonstrated an unquenchable dedication and an ardent enthusiasm as they strained feverishly to complete the task. Third, it is clear that Julius Caesar, who was to come centuries later, had no monopoly on the tactics of speed and surprise for which he is justly famous. The enemies of the Jews were completely caught off guard by the speed and drive of Nehemiah and his compatriots. Before they could effectively organize to stop the Jews or destroy their work, the walls and gates were restored. Fourth, this section of Nehemiah is also interesting because it is one of the best sources on the topography of ancient Jerusalem. Fifth, the passage shows the involvement of the whole Jewish community, as is demonstrated by the mention of representatives of crafts, trades, towns, and various social classes. So that's how this guy saw it. He was able to pull 5 points from it. We're going to take a little different tact and actually look at what Nehemiah did and how it turned out. The chapter is really easy to analyze if you're the type that likes to get into this stuff. It is constructed around the 7 gates of the city of Jerusalem, and it moves in a counterclockwise direction, beginning with the sheep gate on the north. On the north side of the city, it's next to the temple enclosure, and then it eventually returns to that same spot in verse 32. And the chapter devotes a paragraph or a group of paragraphs to each section, as we'll see, of the workers that are involved there. We've talked a bit about this before, but when Nehemiah first arrived in Jerusalem, one of the ways I think you can describe the people that he encountered there was comatose. They saw the condition of the walls. They weren't energized to really do anything about it. English historian Arnold Toynbee writes about apathy. He says, apathy can only be overcome by enthusiasm. And enthusiasm can only be aroused by 2 things. First, an ideal which takes imagination by storm. And then second, a definite, intelligible plan for carrying that ideal into practice. Now, last week we looked at the development of this intelligible plan, but here in chapter 3 we actually see it unfolding, we see it working. The chapter shows us, this chapter, another of the great dynamics of Christian leadership, of effective leadership, even outside the Christian world. And I use the word dynamic on purpose. It is, according to Merriam-Webster, a force or factor that controls or influences a process of growth, change, interaction, or activity. So we're going to look at some of these dynamics. This is really just a review of what we've already covered. I don't know that I presented them to you in this exact list, but you should at least recognize the topics. The first of these great dynamics is the relationship of the leader to God. And in our earliest of sermons in this series, we took a look at how Nehemiah understood God, what he knew about him, his familiarity with God and his promises, and how this knowledge made its way into his praying. Nehemiah knew to put first things first, and God was the first thing in Nehemiah's list. The second of these dynamics is the relationship of the leader to his earthly superior, and in some cases, superiors. Now, we understand that God is our ultimate superior, but there's very few people, period, much less in this room, who don't have to answer to someone. Most all of us do. We have at least a supervisor or a boss, if not many. And so it's important for us to know how to work well and work creatively with these supervisors, these bosses, these superiors. Nehemiah did that. We looked extensively at his dealings with King Artaxerxes, how he was able to respond wisely to the king's inquiries, and it resulted in him getting everything he needed to get the task done. The third relationship we want to look at is that of the leader to those he'll be leading, those, if you want to say it this way, below him, and for those for whose work he or she is responsible. And this involves things we've looked at primarily, such as setting goals, providing motivation. These are the things that Nehemiah will need to do with those that he leads. And he really excelled in this. You have to remember, he's dealing with a discouraged people. They have a history of defeat. It's not the same as dealing with an energetic group who's excited about the future. These people were just the opposite of that. And yet Nehemiah was able to lead them effectively. But it's not just the people that we have to deal with. It's also a leader has to deal with the work itself. How do you approach the actual job? And that may be the most important thing. That's what we see in this chapter, the relationship to the work. Because not only did he need to know to motivate these people, but Nehemiah had to be a task specialist. That is the person who can get things done. He was not just a theoretical tactician, but he was able to get things done, both through his planning and through his actual working. So let's look at how he did that. How was he a task manager? Well, the first thing we see in Nehemiah, it's not really mentioned by many because it's so obvious. You read the chapter and it's the first thing you notice is that he divided the work into manageable sections. He divided up the work. Even though it may be obvious, it's critical. Can you imagine taking a discouraged people and showing them the length of wall in linear feet that they would have to rebuild and just say, okay, let's go do it? That type of job would seem impossible and may very well have been impossible, but that's not what he does, is it? He divides it up into small sections and finds these individuals in their groups, their people, to help build these small sections. By doing that, the job became manageable. The second thing that Nehemiah did, it's obvious from reading the chapter, is that he assigned different teams to each part. First, he divided the project up into sections, and the second thing is he assigned people for each section. Very practical, right? And this is what the chapter is about. When you read it, and when you get past the names that are difficult to pronounce, that's what you see. This section from this gate to this house, or this section of the wall, however it is described, was assigned to this person or people. But there are some important points in here, and I think we need to pay attention to them. The first one I want to point out is that Nehemiah delegated authority. He delegated authority. He may have made the assignments. Maybe people volunteered for sections. We don't know. But after he made those assignments, it seems that he allowed each group of workers to proceed as it saw fit. And we can see that as we go through the story even further, you'll notice slight variations in the way people built. There was not a uniform, you have to do it this way, sort of mandate. So he gave them incredible freedom. He delegated that to them. Now look, delegation is difficult for some of us, isn't it? Do we have any control freaks in the room Don't raise your hands. I'm sure there are. In a group this size, it's difficult to hand stuff over to someone else to do. But delegation is important. Robert Townsend writes, "Delegation creates a climate in which people grow. Make sure the jobs you give your people are whole and important, and that you really give them the jobs. Hand them off to them. Ask them not to report unless they're in trouble. And then grit your teeth and don't constantly ask them how it's going." That's not just delegating the task, but delegating the authority that goes along with it. Nehemiah did that. The second truth we can glean from this is that Nehemiah got everyone involved. I mean, just look at the number of people that we read just a few minutes ago. Various types of people. The names of 41 heads of the task force were read, and the names of places from whence they came. The names of their fathers and grandfathers in some instances. And the types of workers. Let's look at that for a moment. Everyone was involved. The first type we see are the priests. Now look, I didn't grow up in a church that had priests, but I grew up in a church that had pastors. And first, I would almost question whether it was wise for Nehemiah to delegate actual work to a bunch of pastors. But he did. And it seems to have worked. But the priests here must have played an important part. They are mentioned at the very beginning, including the high priest, Eliashib, in verse 1. They're also mentioned at the very end, in verse 28. After the narrative has made its way all around the walls of Jerusalem. They're even mentioned in the middle, along the way, in verses 17 and verse 22. And now you might think that the priests could have excused themselves, saying, "Well, this is not my calling. I will give you spiritual guidance as you need it, as you're building and doing the hard work." But to their credit, they didn't do that. Moreover, we read that when they completed their work, they dedicated it or consecrated it to God. We see they did that with both the Sheep Gate and the Tower of the Hundreds. Those are in the early verses that we read. This shows how they regarded their labor. Their labor was to God. It wasn't just for Nehemiah. The product, the finished product of the wall was done for God. The next type of person that we see are the men of Jericho. Now, Jericho was a good way off from Jerusalem. I can easily see them arguing that the reconstruction of Jerusalem was of little interest to them. Later on in the verses, we even see the residents of other cities mentioned. Tekoa, Gibeon, Mizpah, Zanoa, Beth Hakaram, Beth Zur, and Leila, all mentioned as other towns, villages, where men came to work on Jerusalem. We see union men, guild workers. It almost seems a contradiction for union men to work on a project that's not a union project. And yet it says they did. Verse 8 mentions Uziel, the son of Harhaya, goldsmiths, and Hananiah, one of the perfumers. Verse 31, we see another goldsmith, a man named Malchijah. More goldsmiths are mentioned in verse 32. These were skilled craftsmen. They might have complained that the construction was really not in their field, or someone like a goldsmith, a jeweler even, could complain that working with stones and sledgehammers and such could damage his hands and affect his career. But again, it appears they took on their fair share of work, these guild members. We also see city officials. At several points, you will see that a person is listed as a ruler over a certain district, or in some cases, over half of a district. And it's interesting that these city rulers, these politicians, were not above working with both the poor and the middle class as they labored on these walls. Next, we see women. Women were not expected to do this type of construction work, but evidently they did. At least some did. Verse 12 tells us Shalom, the ruler of half district of Jerusalem, he and his daughters worked on that section of the wall. We also see temple servants. They're mentioned in verse 26 as living on Ophel, which was a big hill, and as making repairs, quote, to a point opposite the water gate on the east and the projecting tower. See, this was their area of the city, and they were taking responsibility for it. And then we see temple servants mentioned again in verse 31. We see city guards. Verse 29, one is mentioned, although there may have been others working there as well. His name was Shemaiah, and he would have been the Jewish equivalent to a security official or a policeman, and he was working on the walls as well. In verse 32, we see merchants. Between the upper chamber of the corner and the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. Now, it's not strange, really, to see the merchants and the goldsmiths working together. They were really of the same class, and they were very similar in their professions, that it would bring them together quite often. But what is strange is to find them working at all. Their business was trade. And so you might expect them to have been trading now, maybe profiting from the situation. There were materials that needed to be purchased. So you might expect these merchants to be providing that at a fair or maybe even an unfair price. But apparently they were not. They were working right alongside the others. To me, that's quite an achievement because of the variety of people. But yet, to be fair, and maybe as an encouragement to us as we try to organize things, we probably need to point out that Nehemiah did not achieve 100% success. Verse 5 tells us that the Tekoite nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord. And I think the truth we can get from here is that there's always going to be a few like this. Nehemiah had them. We will too. In any project we undertake, there's always going to be some who don't want to play. They don't want to participate. But what we should note is the attitude of the nobles, these leaders, did not really affect the men of Tekoa. Not only did they build the section of the wall referred to in verse 5, but they apparently built another section too. Nehemiah records this in verse 27. It says the Tekoites repaired another section opposite the great projecting tower as far as the wall of Ophel. So, all right, this is a lot of detail about a building project happened thousands of years ago by people that we don't know, never heard of, most of them before. So why do we take time out of a worship service to even cover this? What can we learn from it? Okay, so maybe you learned some truths about what Nehemiah did, but how does that matter to us today? So the question, again, as is so often my question at the end of a text, is so what? And I mean no disrespect. I'm not trying to be irreverent. But if we're going to teach something from the Bible, if we're going to read and learn from the Bible, the question is, why is that chapter there? Why does it matter to us here today? And I think that's a fair question that we can ask all the time. Oftentimes, the Old Testament foreshadows something in the New Testament that we need to take note of. Often, it's a messianic type foreshadowing. We read of something in the Old Testament, a story or a reference that very clearly points forward to Jesus Christ in the New Testament. And I think this chapter is one of those examples from the Old Testament that illustrates a New Testament principle that easily applies to us. You see, the success of Nehemiah in involving the entire population of Judah in this project is something we need to take note of, because for today, in the church, everyone is to be involved. Here's the pattern for us from the New Testament. Ephesians chapter 4. We'll begin with verse 11. And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. This is the basis to what we commonly refer to as every member ministry. It means that the ministers in the churches are to prepare the people in the churches to do the church's work. That is, clergy teach the laity, if you like those distinctions. And then the laity are to do the work of serving each other in here and serving the world out there. Nehemiah did that. He recruited everyone, all types of people, all classes of people, from different places, different jobs, male and female, all to work on this project. Now, the Old Testament illustration is slightly different in that the project ends. At some point, they're going to complete the wall and the work there will be over. But for us, the project doesn't end. Verse 12 says that the pastors, etc., are to equip the saints for the work of ministry. And then the next verse, 13, says, until. Okay, so when do we stop? Until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. When do you think that's going to happen? This week? Next week? To the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. The project that we've been recruited to is going to last the rest of our lives. We will be serving each other and serving the world around us for as long as we have breath, if we're going to follow the example of the Old Testament story of Nehemiah and of Ephesians here in the New Testament. But there are still a couple of things we can learn from Nehemiah before we end today. We've seen how he coordinated the effort. But we also need to see, not only did he divide the task into small units, not only did he assign the right people to each part, but he also fit the whole project together so that there were no gaps. Each team picked up right where the other ones left off. We see this in frequent phrases throughout here, like the adjoining section, or the next section, or next to them, or next to him. So not only did Nehemiah coordinate the work so there were no gaps and that everyone worked closely to each other, he also seems to have arranged the work in a way that was both convenient for the workers and a motivation for the workers. And that is, many were assigned or chose portions of the wall in front of or directly adjacent to their houses. The priests rebuilt the area near the temple in verse 1 and verse 28. The temple servants did the area near their dwelling on the Temple Mount in verse 26. Jediah, the portion of the wall opposite his house, verse 10. Benjamin and Hashub, the portion of the wall in front of their house, verse 23, and so on and so on. This would be convenient. There's no commute. No one has to go home for lunch. They're already home. But it would also ensure good work, because you can imagine that a person would be certain to build strong walls in the area in front of his house. You see, the best manager recognizes that there is always an element of self-interest. Even with your best workers and even on your most noble tasks. The final element we see in Nehemiah's work is that he seems to have recognized the accomplishments of each worker. I mean, chapter 3 suggests that. That's what the whole thing is, isn't it? Isn't he recognizing the work of all of these people, the sections that they worked on? I think it's a safe assumption to say that this is just a sample of what Nehemiah did during this project. I can be sure that as he made the rounds of the walls, checking on the builders, that he would call them by name and praise them for what they were achieving. And Nehemiah, being Nehemiah, as we look through this, I'm sure he wrote it all down too. He was a man of lists. We'll see in chapter 7, there's a list of people who returned from exile. And in chapters 10 through 12, we'll see other important lists. So I know there was a list somewhere of exactly what everyone did on each section of the wall. And here in chapter 3, we have sort of a summary as he just makes his way around the perimeter of Jerusalem, noting who did what. As we close this morning, I'm going to ask our musicians to return to the stage. So we see that Nehemiah recognized all the workers that worked on this project, that is, all but one. Did you notice that in this long list of names, Nehemiah did not list himself? Now, if you were paying attention, there is a person named Nehemiah in the list, but this is not him. That's a different Nehemiah. You see, Nehemiah was as active as anyone else, of course, maybe even more so. But when it came to giving credit, he didn't do what Nebuchadnezzar did 140 years earlier. Listen to this verse. This is from Daniel chapter 4, verse 30. It's Nebuchadnezzar looking out over his own city, and here's what he says. And the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" You see, Nebuchadnezzar took glory for himself. By contrast, Nehemiah gave credit to others. And he listed what each one had been assigned and what each one had built. Then, when it was all over, he gave the ultimate credit to God, as he'd done from the beginning. His conclusion in verse 16 of chapter 6 was that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. And I can assure you, no disrespect intended, but you got a group of preachers, policemen, politicians, etc., etc. It would have to be with the help of God for it to be completed. But here, in this chapter, we find a pattern to emulate if we want to strive for excellence in leadership in general, or the completion of a worthy goal, or even to work for the glory of God. Here's how I would close and summarize this. God knows the needs of this church, both in its ministries outside the walls here and the relationships within it. He has also placed each of you here for a purpose. The only hands and feet and arms and legs and hearts and minds that God has to work here are ours, yours and mine. The work is ours to do, and every member ministry. Just like in Nehemiah, we all, each one of us, have a part to do. So if you can imagine for a moment that someone at some point writes down on paper the work of this church, and they just start going down the row and says, this person did this, and that person did that, and this person did that, all through the room, Would at the end they be able to say that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God? Or would it be an incomplete task that they wouldn't even want to attach to the work of God? So the challenge is ours this morning. We have no walls to build around this city or any other, but there's work to do here, and we are the workers, every one of us. And so that's what I want to challenge you with this morning, to spend some time thinking about your role, your place, and what you can do for this body, both within and outside. So let's pray together as we go.